It's Wednesday, December 2nd, 2020, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly discussion on media behaviors comes to you from various locations within the Missouri School of Journalism. I'm here in the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons. I'm your host, and I'm accompanied today by my colleagues Ernest Perry and Kathy Kiley. They're both joining us via Skype. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you, Amy?
Doing okay. Ernest, good to see you again, too.
Good to see you.
On our program this week, the future is female for President-elect Biden's communication team. We'll talk about the women who will be front and center talking to reporters on behalf of Biden and Harris. Our primetime favorites are back, and most of them are addressing the COVID pandemic in one way or another. But is it authentic, really? And
this is NBC 8 News.
It could be the moment we've all been waiting for, when Big Mac.
So that was from one of Jim Reek's early newscasts on KOMU-TV. He signed off yesterday evening after more than 25 years on Mid-Missouri airwaves. We'll talk about our time working with Jim and what makes television anchors like him special in markets like ours. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to today before our half hour is up, but we're going to start with President Trump's first interview since the election with Maria Bartiromo on Fox News.
Thank you for talking with us in the first interview since Election Day. Mr. President, you've said many times that this election was rigged, that there was much fraud, and the facts are on your side. Let's start there. Please go through the facts. Characterize what took place.
Well, first of all, I have to start by saying the whole world is watching, and nobody can believe what they're saying. And you have leaders of countries that call me and say, that's the most messed up election we've ever seen.
Yes, it was. And I purposely decided not to play any more of this interview and run the risk of giving additional airtime to the exaggerations and lies that Bartiromo left unchallenged during the full hour that they were on the air. She asked him a few questions, but Kathy, this was more of a monologue than it was an interview, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that was the problem. It was what Maria Bartiromo did not say. This was giving the president a platform. Obviously, a president of the United States is an important person. You need to listen to them. But part of being a reporter is we're not stenographers. We need to do interviews, and interviews sometimes mean asking tough questions. I think one of the problems with this administration is that you get punished for asking tough questions, and it's become very clear that in order to get access, you don't challenge the president. And so I would suspect that one of the things that was going on here was the reporter felt like she got an interview. There may have been some ground rules established before that interview was set up. And that, again, would be wrong. It's one thing, that's something that celebrities do when they're movie stars. You can't ask them about this or that. That shouldn't be the case with public servants who are on the taxpayer's payroll.
Ernest, even if there were ground rules that were established, shouldn't those have been disclosed at some point during the interview, even if it wasn't about certain topics being off limit, but just even the idea of, I don't know, how long they were going to be talking about or if they were going to focus on certain topics specifically?
Yeah, I mean, that should be disclosed. But I think, you know, Kathy brings up a good point. I think that Maria and the show and the producers, they went into it knowing pretty much that it was going to be a monologue for the president to give him an opportunity to basically, again, present his case for fraud and the election being somehow rigged against him in favor of President-elect Biden. And then they just pretty much let it go without asking a whole lot of questions. I mean, it was literally, I think she may have asked maybe one or two questions at most in the entire interview, and then to lead it off by basically agreeing with the president in terms of the election being somehow rigged against him.
So it's kind of an interesting predicament, especially because, Ernest, you said something about giving him this platform to again lay out this argument on Fox. And we now know, especially a few days past that, we are a few days even deeper into that argument weakening. Again, yesterday with William Barr's announcements, too, that it's even weaker than it was in a weak argument on Sunday. How much of that do you think might have been? We talked a lot 2 weeks ago about Fox needing to redetermine a strategy to figure out how they're going to get that base back that they're starting to lose to Newsmax or to OAN. Was this possibly even a strategic move to move that way? Not necessarily to give the president this unchecked airtime, but to try to bring back the Fox faithful.
You know, I think there's plenty of opportunities for that on their primetime shows, Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson. My guess here is it was a combination of things. One, it was obviously a softball interview, and it was always going to be a softball interview. Mm-hmm. And the effort to gain or attain access is part of that. The other underlying thing here, and it somewhat goes to what you're talking about, Amy, is Trump is a magnet for ratings. And I mean, it's not just Fox. CNN has been accused of overplaying and going to Trump too much. And I think in some ways it's a dilemma for the media. I mean, obviously Trump has a lot of people who voted for him, still has a big base, but he's also equally obviously putting out a lot of untruths. And as a journalist, you really have to think to yourself, you know, this guy's a lame duck. He's a has-been. Why are we focusing so much on him and not on the new guy who's coming in? You know, this is a very unusual time. I can't remember a transition where there was so much focus put on the loser. It really should be all about the guy who's coming in and what's he going to do? What's the future? But again, I think that's partly there's this, you know, there's the fascination of the train wreck going on here, and it's great for ratings, but is it really in the public interest?
So then let's move ahead in that public interest then and move past the train wreck and keep looking and talk about how Biden is moving full steam ahead with the naming of a communications team that will support him and Kamala Harris. And 2020, 2021, it's the year of the woman. The entire team is female. Kathy, tell us about who some of these women are, because I'm guessing you probably interacted with some of them during your time in Washington as well.
The one I know best is Jen Psaki. Jen will be the White House press secretary. Of course, that's a big deal. I think White House press secretaries have become increasingly visible as there's been more and more demand put on the White House. And of course, it was during the Clinton administration that White House press briefings started to be televised on a regular basis. So that makes the White House press secretary a pretty significant figure. Jen Psaki is a young woman, not a baby by any means. She's a veteran. I first met her on the Obama presidential campaign, and she was homeless. She was living out of a suitcase. She told me that she had been traveling so much and going to so many states that she decided to save money by giving up her apartment in Chicago. And she carried around the most enormous suitcase I had ever seen with clothes for all seasons, because when you're traveling with a presidential candidate, you go from Florida to North Dakota, that kind of thing. But she's very sharp. She went on to the State Department during the Obama administration. That, too, has been a training ground for press secretaries. Mike McCurry was the State Department press secretary before becoming the White House press secretary under Bill Clinton. And I think that is good training, because obviously when you're speaking for the president of the United States, you can say things that have a big impact globally. So I'd say she's very ready for the job. And it's going to be refreshing to see a woman who is on the younger side speaking from that podium.
Okay, so Ernest, some of the other people who've been named to this group that stood out to you?
Well, I think the group as a whole sort of stood out to me, because I think you're going to get a different dynamic than what, definitely what we've seen with the Trump administration, and even more so than what we've seen from Obama, because I mean he did have a significant number of women in his cabinet and in his communication team, but not to the standpoint of that you see here. And we're in a different time. So we've gone through the Me Too movement. We've dealt with the backlash. We're dealing with the backlash of that. We've had a pretty contentious election, mm-hmm. where we're still in COVID. And now you have a new team coming in, and they're going to be the face of the Biden-Harris administration. One of the things that I wonder about, though, is there going to be any kind of keeping of what's gone on in terms of Trump? We pretty much don't have the White House press briefings anymore. Are they going to come back? And if so, in what way are they going to come back? What is going to be the relationship between the press and the press and the White House? It was definitely contentious under Trump, but Obama had his own issues as well.
It was not exactly rosy, you know, and people forget that, because worse is a whole lot worse than bad.
Right. So, I mean, so now there's a push by the press, in particular the press in Washington, to bring back some of these things that have been missing in the Trump administration. And also, on top of all of that, you had not only a president who went after the press and encouraged his supporters to go after the press, in some cases physically. You had press freedoms being pretty much, you know, in trouble across the world. And you didn't have the United States, in particular President Trump, basically pushing back and saying, no, the press needs to be free and open. So are we going to see a shift back to press freedoms again?
And you also have the additional layer, another one of the aspects of the legacy of the Obama administration's media strategy, which was to cut out the media entirely and go directly to the electorate using social media or different internet platforms. That they were able to get their message out there in a way that didn't require the gatekeepers that would hold them accountable to some of that messaging and following through with it.
I don't see Biden as a tweet guy. I don't think that's going to happen. I think the other interesting thing, and we have a show, I'm going to plug it, that's going to be on KBIA tomorrow night, that our students at Global Journalist produced.
Yeah.
And they did a very interesting interview with some former VOA directors talking about what the Trump administration has done there. Joe Biden's transition chief is a former governor of the Board of Broadcast Governors for the United States. So those changes are going to be undone right away. I think some of these press relations are going to be repaired pretty quickly. Joe Biden has a very different relationship with the press corps than Donald Trump did. In fact, he has a relationship with the press corps, which Donald Trump didn't. And I think he values that relationship. So I think you're going to see some dramatic changes very quickly.
Okay, Ernest, there was something else you were about to say there too.
No, I was a lot of what yeah. Kathy said was what yeah. I was going to say. The other thing I would say is that Joe Biden's going to need the press
yeah.
because that's the only one of the only ways he's going to be able to communicate what needs to the information that needs to be out there about how do we battle COVID-19. How do we deal with the distribution of the vaccine, and without having the kind of relationship that's necessary, it's going to be difficult for him to be able to get his message out about how we deal with that.
Okay, so let's shift gears a little bit. Saturday Night Live, it stayed on with new episodes through the weekend of the election. We had talked about some of the efforts that they went to get Kamala Harris's suit just right. Well, right after that sketch aired, guest host Dave Chappelle delivered what I consider to be a pretty good monologue. There was one part that got me, though. He was talking about his great-grandfather, who was born a slave.
It's a pretty amazing story my great-grandfather had. And I thought about him all day today because I wish I could see him now. I wish he could see me. Because I wonder what he would say. This week, I flew to New York on a private jet to host Saturday Night Live. Netflix started streaming a show that bears his name. Chappelle Show. And HBO Max is streaming it. And I didn't get paid for any of it. Yeah, if he could see me now, he'd probably be like, this got bought and sold more than I have.
You might have caught that laughter at the end of the joke. It was a bit mild, if we were to describe mild laughter. And maybe it's because the audience wasn't sure if they should have laughed at that joke or not. I know when I was watching it, that was a reaction I had. But now we know that joke was a message and someone at Netflix got it. Ernest, going back years, you and I have talked about Chappelle and his comedy on Views of the News before, but I don't know that the public really had a sense of the conditions under which he was producing a lot of that early work. Now that we know a little bit more of that, Netflix really did do him a favor by taking that down, didn't they?
No, they absolutely did. I mean, one of the things that the point that he was trying to get across to the audience was that, look, you know, they're making money off of a show that I produced long after I'm gone, and I'm not seeing any of the residuals for that. Yes, he's admitted this. I signed a contract, which basically signed over all of that, but that still doesn't make it right. And so the people at Netflix recognize that and realize it, and they know that they have a commodity in Dave Chappelle, and they have a relationship that they've built with him that is going to bring in, way more money and publicity in his specials than they would ever get from re-airing the Chappelle Show. Now, HBO, on the other hand, and Viacom, which also has the rights to that through Comedy Central, mm-hmm. are continuing to produce that. And Dave Chappelle has produced an 18-minute monologue on it that he put out on I think it's on YouTube. You can pull it up, where he basically explains the whole situation with them and the problems that it caused. But even if you look at this past and outside of what of Dave Chappelle himself, this is one of the things that recording artists and other artists have complained about for years, which is the contract in signing these contracts. It almost feels as if they're signing away their lives because their work, they're not being adequately compensated for their work in perpetuity. Well, and that's what he was talking about.
In his case, too, that he was in a very different place personally, financially. He was in a state of desperation. So He was signing something to get paid in the moment, not thinking about the long-term ramifications of its use in perpetuity. Kathy, he said that because of that, it kind of made me thinking. He did say it's legal, but it doesn't mean that it's right. So, Kathy, help me put a different lens on this. I started thinking about this and started thinking about maybe some of the child actors that we have seen over the years. The first show that popped into my head was Different Strokes, and thinking about Dana Plato, thinking about Todd Bridges, about some of the different life experiences, about things that happened maybe with child actors who had guardians or custodians or people holding their trusts who stole from them. Are we exploiting them by continuing to have their shows in that same type of a broadcast cycle with residuals that they're maybe not being compensated for too?
Well, I think it really depends case to case. I mean, obviously, there are some child actors who've had their parents could be a professional talent agent. You know, they've negotiated like crazy. Somebody like Chappelle is really almost more vulnerable than a kid because you don't have a guardian. You know, you're a young person. You're out there. You're trying to make a name for yourself. And I think a lot of companies exploit that. And then if they get lucky, like they did with Chappelle, they can just keep collecting the money that he made for them. And I think this is, you know, this is just something about these contracts. It's similar to, in a certain way, to the non-disclosure agreements we've talked about before, that you're taking a job and you don't really think anything of it. Yeah, I really want this job. And you're willing to sign all of this stuff because you really have no leverage. Mm-hmm. However, everybody signs this is part of the thing. And I'm sure that's what Chappelle was told when he signed the initial contract. He was just happy to have a contract. But then for the companies to continue to, you know, maybe there should be some kind of a look back provision in these contracts where after a certain number of years, they have to be renegotiated, because that would put everybody on a fairer playing field. But what a lot of these companies are doing is making a bet. And if it pays off, it pays off great for them. But the person at the other end, and Chappelle is lucky. Mm-hmm. He's successful. He has a platform. He was able to put public relations pressure on this company. There are a lot of other people who are not so lucky. And so I don't know. I don't know how you that's an entertainment lawyer question. But if I were an entertainment lawyer, I think I'd be looking for ways to protect young artists.
Okay, so here's another TV-related topic to throw at you. I first noticed it and said something to my mom about it while we were watching an episode of Law & Order SVU, but it's not just there. And while what I'm about to play is a clip from NBC's show Superstore, it's not just an NBC issue either.
We're fine. You know, everything's fine. In fact, in my panic dream last night, the person clubbing me to death was Topher Grace, so... little taste of Tinseltown for y'all.
So what you hear isn't nearly as important as what you can see in that clip, how the characters are wearing, or not, their masks in that scene. They're either wearing them under their chin, dangling from one ear, holding them, leaving them on a table in front of them. On SVU, the detectives roll up on a scene and rip off their mask as soon as they start a conversation. It's antithetical to everything we know about COVID safety and how to make safe use of masks. Ernest, it's got to be a tough call, though. Are you authentic to the protocols and ruin your audio, or do you produce a show like what we're seeing on primetime every night?
Yeah, it's definitely been tough for entertainment. In watching the premieres of these shows roll out in November, it seemed like every show, the first show, they dealt with the pandemic straight up. But the nuances, as you talked about, were definitely there. And every time they got ready to say a line, the mask would come off, but then they'd put it back on. You would have, whenever they were outside, they were wearing a mask, but then you'd go into a room with a whole bunch of other people and nobody's wearing masks, and you kind of go like, okay, how do you deal with this? And so they're trying to figure it out. I mean, I think that's one of the issues that they're dealing with right now. They're basically trying to figure out what's going to work for them.
So, Kathy, let me throw a what if at you. What if primetime TV had just ignored the pandemic and let the characters live in their universes that their characters were in last December and kept it going? Would it made it more obvious to audiences, less obvious? What do you do there?
Yeah, I think they easily could have done that. And it would have made the shows less dated and avoided the problem that you alluded to. I mean, if you do the right thing by sort of advertising placement, you're going to have muffled audio. If it would be anything like the classes I teach, they'd be, huh, what? But I don't know. I mean, I think if you're going to do it and you know, I will say this for the shows. The way the masks are worn is sadly pretty cinema verite. I mean, it looks a lot like what you see out in public. One would want us to model a little bit better, but I think it's hard to do that and maintain audio quality. And probably the best thing, I think a lot of these shows are kind of in this rip from the headline mode. Personally, I don't know about you, but I think a lot of us living in the pandemic don't need to be reminded of
that
it.
First thought. Like, I'm here to be entertained. Do I need to be reminded that I can't go anywhere without a mask, or that I haven't seen loved ones, or that the three of us can't be sitting around the table together having this conversation? Like, this is supposed to be my, like, escape time.
Exactly. When I listen to sports, I tend to listen to it on the radio rather than watch it on TV, so I don't have to see the empty stands.
Okay. If you turn into KOMU TV this evening or throughout this week, you're going to likely miss seeing a familiar face, one that was on the station for 23 years and on other Mid-Missouri airwaves before that. Jim Reek's retirement is one that's hard for a lot of people, not only here in the Columbia, Jefferson City, and in his hometown in Fulton, but across the country. I remember my earliest days out at KOMU, and it was soon after Jim came on board replacing Rex Hodges. And from the earliest days, he was the kindest, most supportive mentor to new reporters and producers like me. And there are more than 20 years worth of people who've gone through KOMU working around the globe with similar stories like mine. It's interesting though, Kathy, because I want to ask you, you worked with Jim on election night right here in this studio. So is someone who maybe had the most minimal working experience with Jim, your reflections on that?
What a total class act. And I think you're seeing that reflected in the tributes like the beautiful one you just paid to him. And I think there's something really important about the role that Jim Reek plays, or Chris Trevino, who also just retired. These are people, and I hope our journalism students are listening up. They made their careers by staying in one place and becoming fixtures in their community and building relationships of trust with their audience. And that is one thing we need more of in our society, is trust. So Jim Reek is like the Walter Cronkite of mid-Missouri. He's somebody who comes into your living room every night, and if he says you should wear a mask, you're going to do it because you trust him. So having somebody who's a long-term entity like that, who's been around, is a familiar face, a familiar voice, it's so important. And I hope that some of our younger journalists are inspired by that example and do the same thing.
Ernest, what do we lose when we have a generation of TV journalists coming up after Jim who really do come to a market, look for their next contract, and leave?
Well, I think what we lose is the longevity. We lose the experience. Mm-hmm. We lose someone who has that institutional memory, that history, and understand it. I mean, one of the things that they talked about in the tribute on KOMU for him last night was the fact that, you know, the Friday night footballs that they did every Friday, that was him.
That was Jim's franchise for decades.
That was his franchise for decades. And he was the guy. You knew during football, high school football season, he was going to be there. And for many of these communities, high school football is it. That's their deal. And to have him come out to their game was a big deal. Where was Jim going to be on Friday night? Was he going to be in Harrisburg, or was he going to be in Fulton, or was he going to be in Centralia? You just kind of wanted to know where he was going to be. And that's the kind
of
guy.
That's how you knew where the biggest game of the week was going to be, too, and
absolutely,
where everybody should be looking in high school football. One other part of Jim's legacy as a broadcaster is going to be the love that he has for the city of Joplin, and the way that he went to college in Joplin, but how he even further adopted that city following the tornado that happened there in the early 2000s, and how that was a story he continued to follow. Straight to yesterday's weather quiz question that Kent and Jawicki asked him during the newscast was something directly related to that tornado. We only have a few more seconds before our show's going to be up today. A bit of a public service announcement I want to share with our audience. The New York Times is making free digital subscriptions available to high school students and their teachers across the country. There's information on our links blog about how you can take advantage of that offer and encourage your teens' teachers to consider it. It's never too early to build a daily news habit. And I do want to note, because we're always saying it's important to pay for news, this offer is free to readers because a corporate sponsor is subsidizing the subscriptions. We're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can always check out what we're going to be talking about on our Facebook page or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave comments or questions, see what we'll be talking about next week. Thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing the show, Aaron Hay for handling the audio, and Tim Pilcher, who composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. We'll be back with you next week.